mentioned in the announcements the response to Operation Christmas Child. I wanted to do it now. That way it gets recorded and it's part of the message, but it also will be included in the live stream in the second service. The reason I'm doing that is because the people who led us in Operation Christmas Child, Christy Jones, she and Tracy are gone today. They are at one of the regional collection centers where they are helping to process boxes from all over the country in anticipation of shipping. Ted and Sonia Moore also lead our regional collection that we do here at the church for everyone in this area, and they too are gone. They're at a processing center in Colorado, and so none of them are here to receive the support for the tremendous leadership they provided us. However, the report is this: the last official number for the Southwest St. Louis area, of which we are a part, was 28,180 shoeboxes collected. Each of these boxes represents a gospel opportunity somewhere in the world. Our church gave 953 boxes. Our drop-off center, our regional site here at the church, collected 2,800 boxes. It's interesting to note that there are about 200 participating churches and organizations within the Southwest St. Louis area, and our church alone accounted for 3% of the total of the 28,000. It is an awesome support to receive from the for this ministry, both here in our church locally, as well as the churches in our region that participate. And so they want to give to you, the church, their thanks and appreciation. As leaders, I want to join them in doing that, but also to give our appreciation to Christy and to everyone who helped her, and to Ted and Sonia for their fine leadership in this tremendous ministry. It certainly has grown over the last years, and we anticipate that continued upward trend. How about a round of applause for all of that? All right. Today we begin a new series. So how do you talk about Christmas 33 times in a row? I don't know. At some point, you're just going to repeat yourself, aren't you? So today, we're beginning our Christmas series that will carry us through the season of Advent as we focus our attention on the Son of God. The title of the series is Unto Us a Son, and we're going to talk about it from the perspective of several different attentions and theological principles. First of all, we're going to talk about Jesus as the Son of God. We're going to talk about next week Jesus as the Son of Man. We're going to talk about Jesus as the Son of Mary, and we're going to talk about Jesus as the Son of Sacrifice. And so each week we're going to add a different dimension from the Christmas story that informs our understanding of who Christ is. So this becomes more than just attention on the birth of Jesus alone, but rather the birth and our celebration of the birth of Christ, representing the incarnation, that is Christ coming to this earth, God with us, God in the flesh, understanding him from all the different perspectives that the Bible presents him, so that we have not only a deeper, more informed understanding of who Christ is, but we also have a more profound celebration of the Christmas season. It's much more than just the observance of a holiday. It has to be more than that in order for it to have significance and power in our lives. And so today we look at Jesus, the Son of God. The passage that we will return to throughout the course of this series is found in Luke's Gospel in chapter 1, beginning with verse 26. And there we read the Christmas story from Luke's perspective. He says, "In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth, to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David. And the virgin's name was Mary. And he came to her and said, "Greetings, O favored one, the Lord is with you." But she was greatly troubled at the saying and tried to discern what sort of greeting this might be. And the angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you will call his name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give to him the throne of his father David. And he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." And Mary said to the angel, "How will this be, since I am a virgin?" And the angel answered her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the child to be born will be called Holy, the Son of God." So today, we focus our attention on Jesus, the Son of God. Jesus is described in this passage as one who will be great, the Son of the Most High, the eternal ruler of the kingdom of God, the one who comes as the fulfillment of the covenant of promise in the lineage of David. He is described as holy, and finally, he is described as the Son of God. Isaiah 9:6 says this, "For to us a child is born, and to us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." Over and over again, we see the emphasis on Christ as the Son of God. We see the emphasis on the deity of Christ, and that is really what we're talking about here. When you read 1 John, you'll find that 1 John was written in order to counteract the effects of false teaching that was taking away the deity of Christ. When you look at religions in the world today, many of them claiming to be either Christian or associated with Christianity are in fact false religions because they do not ascribe full deity to Christ. When you look at them and they start to diminish the deity of Christ, saying that he is a son of God, not the son of God, saying that he is a created being rather than holy God, pre-existent from all time and before time itself existed. When you take away the deity of Christ, you take away the very essence of all that enables your salvation. When you diminish the deity of Christ, you diminish the very element that is associated with who Christ is, that not only offers us hope, but ensures that hope for all eternity. There is simply no way that you can overstate the significance, the importance, or the value of understanding Jesus as the Son of God. Let's talk about it from three perspectives, and we'll do this each week using the same perspectives so that we have some consistency from one to the other. First of all, the justification for the deity of Christ. I'm using justification as a way of saying the importance of, the reason why, the nature. All of those things are contained here. I'm not using it in the theological sense of justification from sin. I'm using it in a more academic sense of why this is important and why you and I need to understand the deity of Christ. Justification for the deity of Christ. First of all, Jesus is God and has always been God. Listen to what is said in John's Gospel in chapter 1, verse 1. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Jesus, it says, in the beginning was with God. And it says that Jesus, in the beginning, was God. The Bible attests over and over of itself, reminding us that Jesus is God and has always been God. Why is it that we can make this emphasis, and where does this come from, and why is it so important? It is because the Bible itself makes this emphasis, and the Bible itself teaches this over and over. So the question then for me is, why would anybody see it otherwise? If you are going to call yourself a Christian, if you're going to enter into a faith relationship of some description in which you trust in God and rely on that relationship through the grace given in Jesus Christ, why on earth would anybody ever diminish or take away from the deity of Christ? Why do we take away from God's deity for any reason? It's always the same. It's in order to elevate our own importance. The only reason that we ever have for diminishing God is in order to elevate ourselves. That is true when we look in the garden and we see the fall of man. No, you won't die. You'll become like God. And then that sin is repeated in every human being that came into existence after that, and will continue to be repeated in every human being that exists until Jesus comes and judges sin and restores that which sin has damaged. But the whole point behind it and the whole rationale is simply a continuation of the age-old effort on the part of evil, either that which resides within us or around us, to elevate self or something else above that of God. If Christmas does nothing else for us, if it draws no other attention than this, that it elevates in those moments of reflection the deity and the eternal nature and the absolute authority and the sovereign supremacy of Jesus Christ, then it will have accomplished its purpose. But if it does everything else and your seasonal celebration accomplishes all of your goals and all of the things that you think should be there, but does not elevate Jesus, you will have miserably failed. There simply can be no compromise. Jesus is God. He has always been God, and the only reason that we have to diminish that or to deny that is in order to elevate ourselves. You say, well, I would never deny that Jesus is God. And yet, the Bible teaches us that anyone who does not do that which he has commanded does not trust in him. Now, I don't know about you, but I struggle in order to be obedient. I struggle with my own failure. I struggle with the temptation towards self-centered interest. I am often more concerned with what concerns me than that which concerns God, and I find myself absolutely overwhelmed at times. I believe that within us dwells that nature of sin and evil that is contrary to the will and way of God, to the degree that we face this constant battle as long as we have breath. It is why worship is so important. It breaks down those barriers. It brings us into personal connection. It reminds us of our contact. It is why daily Bible reading, it's why prayer is so vitally important to the life and lifeblood of the believer. It is only through this constant infusion of truth into our minds, into our lives, into all that we experience that we can have hope to dwell with God and to not be overwhelmed by the desire to elevate self. Jesus is God and has always been God. The response of the followers of Jesus in the days in which he lived on this earth clearly testified to his deity. Jesus was conceived by the Holy Spirit, anticipated by prophets of old, verified by the miracles that he performed, such as healing diseases, having the authority over nature itself, and the ability to raise the dead to life. He is declared throughout the New Testament as God by his followers. He himself was then resurrected victorious over death, and he bodily ascended into heaven, from which he will return one day to reestablish his ultimate reign over all of creation. The Bible over and over and over shows us teaches us, demonstrates in front of us that Jesus is God. There's simply no question about it. And the only way that we can minimize that and the only way that that can ever be overcome is to deny the Bible. Once again, we are brought back to one of those core values that we rely on so heavily here, and that is the truth. We rely on truth. We are committed to teaching truth. We are committed to preaching truth. We are committed to living and helping one another to live truth, because Jesus, who is God, is the truth. All of it connects. And we can see those connections when we are unwilling to allow ourselves to be drawn away by all of these other things. Colossians 2:9, Paul says, "For in Him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily." I just don't know how we can say it clearer. And I don't know how the Bible can be more repetitive, over and over reminding us that the reason why the deity of Christ is important and our justification for it is because it was important to God. Now, from just an aside to all of that, what I've given you is what I wrote down. This I didn't write down. Understanding the justification for the deity of Christ is something that easily becomes either a mantra or, I guess, just a tradition, so that we speak the words, but we don't hear them. Or we hear the words, but we don't feel them. Or we know the truth, but we don't live it. Or we understand the call, but we don't do it and aren't transformed by it. One of the things that I don't want any message that I preach or any time that we gather for worship to do, I don't want it to ever be a simple routine that we are following. It's hard to overcome that. It really is. Like you, I have the leftovers of the holiday. My dad came up and spent Thanksgiving with us, and Justin and Jennifer and their children came and stayed during that time, and Brad and Brianna and their children came, and we gathered together on more than one occasion, and we celebrated and we shared and we had family time and we did all of that. And it was great. It really was. No one was injured, at least not severely. Nothing was broken that was, you know, couldn't be replaced. Everything went well. It was a great time. But it takes a lot out of you, doesn't it? You know, all of the cooking and the eating and the stuff that you don't normally do and you don't normally have, and you have this leftover, this lag. I can't blame it on tryptophan, because surely that's out of my system by now, but nonetheless, we all feel that. And then to make it even worse, we've got the end of Thanksgiving, and we're in one of those years where you have 6 days less between Thanksgiving and Christmas than you would in a normal year. I don't even know how that's possible. Where are those days? Who took them? Has to be the work of the Grinch, or it has to do with the retail industry trying to promote Black Friday and Cyber Monday even more than they normally do. I don't know. But all of this creates a stress and a press, and we feel it. And then when we come to a time like this, there's a lag. Some of you are still living it because you've got family here that are like the remnants of your turkey. They're your Thanksgiving leftovers that you brought to church. Good for you. It's no excuse for routine. How do we stand before the God of gods? How do we stand before the Creator of all? How do we come and worship the one who gave everything for us and say, well, I'm just tired today. I just need to get through this service. I just need to do my task. I can do all of this other stuff, but I've got to teach my small group first. It won't take long, and we really won't spend a lot of time. And then it's just an hour, and I'll be out. Have you ever said things like that? Have you ever thought those things like that? We all have, and we all have been there. But I'm telling you that what changes your perspective on worship, on Bible study, on the gathering of God's people as the church, what changes everything is not by focusing attention on the people or the church or the task, but by focusing the attention on the deity and the sovereignty of Christ. The more that Jesus is lifted up, the more we start to understand the importance of everything and everyone else. Justification for the deity of Christ. The implication of the deity of Christ globally. What does this mean to the world? It means that because man has sinned against an infinite God, only an infinitely perfect sacrifice can atone for that sin. So have you ever thought about the nature of your sin and you say, well, wait a minute, this is about Jesus and His deity, it's not about my sin. No, it actually is about your sin. The nature of sin is such that because we have sinned against an infinite God, our sin also has infinite consequences. It means that it has an eternal cost and it has an eternal consequence. It requires an infinitely just response to which you and I could never stand up. Who can stand against the wrath of God? Who can stand against all that God would bring to bear for that which has sinned against Him? No one and nothing. The very notion that God would be somehow brought down to our level and then presented as some sort of human judge who does not possess the character and nature of eternity itself is laughable. The very consequences of our sin have an infinite and eternal response that is required. Therefore, the only means by which that sin can be atoned is that the sacrifice must not only be perfect and pure, but it must be infinitely powerful. So that when Jesus died, He didn't die as sinless because you and I are sinful alone. He died as sinless and He died as perfect, but He also died as powerful. It is the very power and nature of Jesus as God that enabled Him to bear the weight of sin in the face of the wrath of holy God. No one else could do that. This is one of those messages that is to have a doctrinal implication and a theological foundation, but when we look at it from this perspective, we see that it also has a global, worldwide implication. This is everybody. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. What does that mean? This is what that means. The implication of the deity of Christ globally is that He alone is able to atone for our sin or the sin of the world. Because only God can atone for sin, and because He has sent Jesus to do that, the gospel immediately and instantly becomes exclusive. Jesus is the only Son of God. So, what do we do with that, and what does that mean? We live in a culture in which cooperation and accommodation has become not just a buzzword, but has become something that seems to be demanded. Compromise and the ability to get along is something that isn't just being presented, but is also something that is now being legislated. You say, well, you know, we won't stand for that. We'll stand against that. Well, we have to be really careful, because a lot of times Christians, well-intentioned and all worked up, will many times find themselves not standing for principles of truth, but will find themselves standing against people who also are sinners just like them. I'm not calling you to raise arms against other people, especially those who oppose. Jesus said they hated him, they're going to hate us as well. We need to understand that and not be surprised by it. But what does it mean for us? It means that the implication of Jesus Christ and his deity on a worldwide scale is that he is the only answer for sin. That's why we can be motivated to go as missionaries around the world. That's why we can sacrificially give to enable those missionaries to share the gospel. That's why we see the need to plant churches so that more people are saved and come to Christ and grow as disciples in faith. That's why we do all these things. Not because it's our obligation and responsibility to give, but because of the implication that unless people receive Jesus, they die and they go to hell. That's the reality. A Christmas message about going to hell doesn't really have the warm feel, does it? Can you smell the cinnamon in the background? No, I can't either. And don't bring cinnamon candles and plug-ins. We don't want false cinnamon in here. It isn't about how we feel warmly. It has to be about how we are motivated truthfully. Jesus is the only means of hope. Exclusively, the gospel is the only hope of the world. Therefore, the only way that you and I can fulfill our calling to bring glory to the name of God and the glory that is given to Jesus is by doing all that he has called us to do to share him with others. Because only God can atone for sin, because he sent Jesus to do that, the gospel is exclusive. In other words, only Jesus saves, and anyone who rejects or denies the deity of Christ is not saved. Because Jesus is God, he both saves and he condemns. Philippians 2, 5 through 9, and I'll probably return to this more than once, says, "Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours, in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name." Clearly, what Jesus did through his sacrifice and what God has done by raising him from the dead has elevated him, giving him the name that is above every name. What are the implications then of Jesus Christ as God on a global scale? It is that you and I who know him also have been called to declare him. Thirdly, not only do we see the justification for the deity of Christ, the implication of the deity of Christ globally, but now the application of the deity of Christ personally. Recognizing that Jesus is God enables our worship. To worship anyone or anything other than true God is what? It's false worship. And false worship is also idolatry. So worshiping anything or anyone other than Jesus Christ is false worship. Worshiping anyone or anything other than Christ is idolatry. Idolatry is the besetting sin that we have seen among the people of God throughout all the ages. So it's been with us a long time. It was the one thing that kept drawing the people away from God when they were following him and being developed into the nation that would ultimately be the light to the rest of the nations. And it constantly was a struggle, because when God would set Israel apart for a purpose and bring them to himself and defend them or deliver them or do something that would enable them to rise to this new position that he had called them to in order to share the glory of God with a world that was lost and a world that was in darkness, they would almost immediately turn away from serving God, turning to what? Other gods. So that the influence of the world was such a crushing presence on the nation of Israel that she struggled almost every day, it seemed, in order to hold any faithfulness and commitment and connection to God. Interesting how we see the world today. The culture that we are a part of in this country has shaped and molded Christian faith to a great extent, so that now we are finding that the battle lines are not over many of the traditional views that we've held in the past, but now we are finding that the battle lines are taking place within the church itself. So that the arguments are over whether or not we should be more like the world or whether or not we should be more like Christ. It is a struggle that has always been with us, and it will remain until Jesus comes. I don't see an end in it. What I do see is that the only way to effectively fight that battle is to do so with a fixed focus on the deity of Christ. That's a personal commitment. So what is that going to mean for you personally? It may mean some challenges in some of the circles that you travel. It may mean some rather uncomfortable conversations with people that you're close to, family or friends. It may mean making choices between things that you have previously been involved with and now realizing that those things are distractions that take you away from or that are not consistent with what Christ has called you to and who He is in you. So that now what is happening is that thing that God is calling you to set aside or to treat in a different way is a thing that elevates you but takes away from Him. And every time we do that, it's idolatry. It's false worship. The purpose of recognizing Jesus as deity in us personally is that it changes our worship so that it isn't something that is routine. It isn't something that is simply a ritual we follow, but it is rather a relationship that is growing. Realizing the grace that is represented in the person and work of God personalizes His call upon our lives. This removes the specter of legalistic religion that relies on man's deeds instead of God's grace. Focusing on the deity of Christ personally reminds me that Jesus didn't die for a group, He died for me. He didn't call a collection of people, He called me. He called me by name in a very personal, individual way. And He did so for you as well. In fact, every person who has ever come in faith to Jesus Christ has come, not because He issued a call to a group, but because He issued a call to a person. The very personal nature of our relationship of faith is one that demands a response to the grace that He has given. It is possible for us to deny that response when it is seen in a group perspective, but it is impossible when it comes to us in a particular way. You say, well, I don't quite get that. Well, let me make it clearer for you with an illustration. You remember things from your past when you're around the people of your past, and so since my dad was here, whenever you're in the presence of a parent, you kind of revert to childhood and some of the things that you experienced as a child. I remember one time, because we were talking about it, that there was a group of us that were in trouble, and we had all participated in the offense. And my father was the interrogation officer that had been assigned to get to the truth. He was very good at it. And so he says to us boys as a group, "Did you all do this?" And we stood silently. Nobody answered. It was a brave front, and I was impressed with our ability to stand in the face of such overwhelming force. But we did so, and it was great. And I thought, we're going to beat the rap. You know, we're going to get away with it. This was going to seal my descent into criminal activity. If this had worked, and I had been able to successfully deny my father's interrogation skills, I'm confident that I would be some sort of sinister criminal right now, running some horrible backroom deal and distant from God. Somehow my father intuitively knew that as well, and so he was trying to save me and the rest of us boys. And so he says to us as a group, "Did you do this?" We stood silently in denial. And then he walked forward. And he stooped down. "Scott, I'm talking to you." And in that moment, all of the courage and all of the resolve and all of the communal commitment that we had made melted away as his gaze came upon me and his breath hit me in the face, and I felt the little flecks of spit sticking to my skin, burning like acid to reveal the truth behind my lies. And I said, "Yes, I did that." And then all of the dominoes fell and the truth was revealed. You can stand against something when you do so anonymously or you do so in an anonymous group. If your religion is anonymous, if your religion is group, and if it relies on your observance of a particular form or a particular fashion, and if it has more to do with what you do and less to do with what Christ has done, then what you have is in fact a religion. It just happens to be a false one. And it cannot save you. But if, on the other hand, the application of that truth that you have discovered in the deity of Christ comes to you in a personal call that invites you out of your sin into a relationship with Him in which He knows your name and you are in the process of learning all that is contained in His. Now you are starting to realize that Jesus didn't die for the world alone. He died for you individually, and grace is now applied in a way that makes a difference to you. That not only defeats your tendency to legalism, but it elevates the very personal obligation that we all share before God. Because Jesus is God, then we have confidence through faith in Him. The personal nature of this relationship gives us confidence so that we know, because of that connection and relationship, that what He did is complete. His finished work is sufficient for our sin, whereas without Him, our faith remains feebly dependent upon us. But with Him and in Him, our faith is utterly dependent on Him, so that there is no doubt leading to fear. There is only confidence that gives hope. Understanding that Jesus is truly God strengthens our faith and increases our commitment and desire to live for Him as we anticipate the fulfillment of faith when He returns. This is transformation, and it leads us to satisfaction. Consider who Christ is to you. Is He a baby in a manger, or is He the eternal Son of God? Jesus said to His disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter said, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the very gates of hell shall not prevail against it." What is it that Peter said that Jesus declared He would build His church on? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. The very foundation of the church and its defense against the gates of hell itself depend on the deity of Christ.